And our special guest tonight, Jeff Ballinger, will be back with Jeff in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Jeff, in 1999, you launched GhostVillage.com. What were you seeking? Why did you do that?
Well, first of all, I was trying to teach myself HTML to give you a boring answer, but I had written a few articles for a newspaper I was working for in the 1990s on the paranormal. You know, October comes around and gets to be Halloween, and this wonderful subject gets the spotlight for a brief moment of the year. And as a journalist, you go looking for the haunted interest stories, the haunted people, the places, the things, and that's really what got me hooked on this. Was not just first researching the history, which drew me in, but then the eyewitness testimony. When you interview enough people and you know who's full of it and who's not and who's really been moved by their experience, that's really what got me hooked. So I took a couple of those articles that I had written for the newspapers and I just put them up on the website. And back in '99, I said, just put on the homepage, hey, tell us about your own ghost experiences. And about every 4 to 6 weeks, someone would send in something and would publish it. And boy, you know, it just grew and grew today. From there and today, I mean, it's not more than every 2 or 3 hours that we have someone send in their own ghost experience. Literally, that many are coming in every single day, and it's just growing exponentially. And I realized there was a real need to have an open discussion on the topic, the religious views, the skeptical views, the believers, the non-believers, the various theories, as a place to just kind of put all things ghostly. And that's really what it's become, kind of a global community.
And you don't point fingers, you don't make fun of people, you just put it out there.
Yeah, I think you have to on this subject because, you know, it's so tough to know for sure. And there are so many people that'll stand up and claim to be a guru and tell you exactly what happens after we die. And I'm not there yet. You know, if I was, I'd be happy to stand on the mountain and profess. But for right now, I just don't know. But what I do know is that something's going on. Something occurs. And maybe if we can get enough information out there and just not judge it, but just consider it, we'll reach some conclusions. You know, I mean, I'm like everybody. I'm on my own spiritual journey. I have my own questions that I've been trying to answer for many years. And everything I learn along the way, I publish in some form or another, either on the website or in books or in magazines and things like that, because I have my own questions. And I think we all do. And you see so many people out there that can get taken in by the charlatans, and it's so sad because I think these folks are just looking for answers too, but they want them the easy way. They want someone to just hand them those answers, and that's just not really possible. The real answers, the profound ones, the ones that stay with you, are the ones you seek yourself. And if my website can help someone do that, if my website can help someone share their experience, learn that they're not crazy, that this is happening to millions of people all over the world, and get some support for what they're going through, then hey, all the better.
Is it possible, Jeff, that we could be wrong, that there is no hereafter, there is no life after death? When we die, that's it. The curtain closes.
You know what? I absolutely accept that as a possibility. And that's one of the problems I have when dealing with some people who call themselves skeptics. I think some of the people, and don't get me wrong, I think we should all be skeptical to some degree, and I think many skeptics bring a great deal to this discussion because, you know, sometimes it's that thing that goes bump in the night is just the pipe in your wall expanding. It's not a ghost. It's not grandpa. But at the same time, some of these so-called skeptics are actually subscribing to a rigid belief system called atheism that has its dogmas, its tenets, its sometimes even its prayers. It seems like, you know, when you just go into a mode and you say, you know, nothing can happen after death because, you know, it hasn't been proved. But what happens is these people believe nothing happens after death, and when given any evidence to the contrary, they clam up. The same way any religious person doesn't want to hear about any views other than their own, other than the ones they already agree with. And so I first of all, I accept that as a possibility, that maybe there is nothing to it. I don't believe it. But and if I were giving it Vegas odds, it would be pretty low, because of all the evidence, because of all the experience, because of near death experiences, because of my own experiences. Think about something as simple as going to a funeral. I remember from a young age being at my grandfather's funeral when I was about 10 years old, And you look at the body, and I remember thinking, you know what? That's weird. It doesn't look like him. It doesn't look like him anymore. It should. We just paid a lot of money for this funeral.
They look like mannequins, don't they?
That's right. Yeah, and the reason is it wasn't him. He was gone. That person that was him, that essence that made up who that person was no longer there. And this was just the empty vessel, the empty shell left.
You know what? You're absolutely right, Jeff. It is as if when the soul leaves, we both believe that,
right,
you're stuck with just the shell. And for some reason, I don't like funerals. I've been to a few. But the body always looks plastic, like it's just a shell.
That's right. And to me, for myself, I think that's one of the things that has driven me. Is from a young age, I looked at that and I said, if there was nothing to it, that should just look like a person sleeping. But it doesn't look like a person sleeping at all. It looks like something is missing. And
I don't think it's the makeup. Do you?
No, I don't. Because, gosh, boy, for what funerals cost today, they do a fine job. No disrespect intended to the undertakers out there, but something's missing, and that something I believe is that life force, that essence that was with that person. And given that, you know, matter can't be created nor destroyed, it's gone somewhere. It's just changed state, and that's one of the basics that has driven me from a young age.
I want you to take us on a death trip, and I'm going to set part of the stage for you, Jeff.
All right,
you pick it up, and this is based on the assumption that you believe that there is life after death.
All
somebody
right.
Somebody goes to bed one night, doesn't feel very well, and he closes his eyes, and at least in this world, he doesn't open them up again. He dies. You come in from there. What happens?
You know, if I knew, I'd be just incredibly wealthy, and but this is where belief and religion have to take over. Dr. Raymond Moody, who's a dear man and wrote the wonderful book Life After Life back in the 1970s, one of the real pioneers,
was on the show a couple months ago.
Great guy, and yeah, just a funny guy too. But a great guy. When he looks at the near death experience, the similarities, for example, the tunnel effect, you know, going through the long, dark tunnel, the light at the end. This is a medical doctor now and a psychiatrist looking at the experience and seeing all those things. I think there's something to that as well. So you close your eyes. You don't wake up in this realm, but you wake up somewhere. And, you know, some would suggest that you're now on another plane. You may call it heaven if you're in a happy place. You may call it hell if you're not. I really don't know, George. I wish I did.
For the moment, though, do you think the individual believes that he may be in a dream? I mean, because the last thing he knows, he went to bed. He didn't feel too good, but he went to bed. And he's not sure. He doesn't know he's dead, does he?
Well, that's the whole thing. You know, I think some of us are conscious of when we're dreaming, but that would be called kind of a lucid dream, if you think about it.
Yes.
When you're in a dream state, you're usually not aware of it. If you are aware of it, then you're not sleeping that deeply. I don't think either of us have a hard time determining if we're dreaming or awake. And I think it's probably the same after we die. You're going to be conscious of what state you're in. You're going to be conscious that you're not asleep and you're not dreaming. I just believe that. Where you will be and how you will get there and what you're able to do once you reach that that understanding, you know, I'm just not sure. And I think there's got to be some kind of transition period, because there's a transition period for everything in life. There's a transition period between, just being born, if you think about the process of labor, you know, from you know, when that embryonic sac, you know, breaks and the water breaks, and you go through a period that's, you know, can be 1 or 2 days long, really, from the start of labor to actual delivery, the severing of the umbilical cord and the whole notion of becoming a separate entity. God, I'm learning so much about children right now. It takes children years to realize that they're not still physically connected to their mother. You know, it takes infants many months before they come to that realization. And because they're still going in that transition period, I would imagine that we have some kind of transition period ourselves in the next life once we die. And that's just based on a gut feeling. But it seems to me that that's the natural order of things, is we get that transition.
So, but I mean, do you think the individual wakes up and sees his body in bed? Is that possible?
I would think that would probably help, you know, because you need to realize you're dead.
That'd be a start.
Yeah, right. I mean, it seems that would be kind of an important part of it. And if you, again, getting back to the work Raymond Moody did, where people, you know, leave their body, may see it on the operating table or, you know, at the scene of a car accident, something like that, and then move forward into that tunnel, I think that's an important part of the understanding that, you know, there's myself, and yet I'm not in there. I think that would be kind of a critical piece to this.
Let's talk a little bit about my favorite month, and that's October.
Yeah.
And one of the things in October is Halloween. I used to remember as a kid just loving the entire moment from when the Disney television network would have, you know, the Ichabod Crane and all those types of Halloween-type feeling shows on. I loved it. I loved every bit of it. Why is it such an important and exciting period for ghost hunting?
Well, for one, we get the center stage this month. You know, it's, you know, folks like you and I are interested in this subject 12 months of the year, but the rest of the world seems to tune in October at least. And what's neat about this, gosh, I remember growing up as a kid, Halloween, really, you only put out decorations and things like that maybe the week before, and that was about it. But that's really changed. This holiday is stretching. You know, it's leaking into September even. You know, if you go to various stores, they've got Halloween decorations up come the second week of September. And that'll go all the way to the 31st. So we get center stage. You know, I joke with my wife. I do a ton of media interviews in October. You know, mainstream rock and roll stations and stuff like that, morning shows. Places that would never, ever talk to me in November or December or January. But in October, you know, they want to have the discussion. And so it's an opportunity, number one, to get the word out about what we do and about, you know, what this whole holiday means. You know, the notion that the world between the veil between the world of the living and the world of the dead is at its thinnest, that this is our modern times Day of the Dead. Every culture has one. This is ours, and it is to be celebrated. We can celebrate the spooky, but we can also have a deeper discussion about what it means. And when I was growing up, God, Halloween was always my favorite holiday. You know, I had the neighbor that went way over the top with decorating their house and playing music, and that just had such an effect on me. And I remember my dad, too, from a young age, he taught my sister and I the idea of charity. You know, we lived in a neighborhood where you could hit quite a few houses in a period of 4 or 5 hours and fill a pillowcase with candy, and we'd bring all that home and set it on the floor. And my dad taught us charity. He'd say, you know, he worked in Bridgeport, Connecticut at the time, and he'd say, you should give half your candy to the poor kids in Bridgeport, and you know, I'll deliver it for you. And so my sister and I would divide up half our candy, and I remember even taking the good stuff too, saying like, well, I guess we should give them some of the good things as well. And we did this every year. It was a tradition. And then I remember when I was a teenager being in his office one day in early November, and his bottom desk drawer was half open. And I looked down, and it was just full of our Halloween candy. And I looked at him, and I said, the poor kids in Bridgeport? And I realized my dad taught us another valuable lesson about charity, that some charities have quite a bit of overhead and take a whole lot for for their cause before passing it on to those in need. So, you know, from a young age, it was a big part of the growing up. But there's so many parts of the culture. There's so many parts of the stories, you know, the ghost stories that we share. It is center stage this month, and I think that we need to relish it, and we need to get people talking about it. Because one thing I've noticed, after each Halloween, I've noticed this, you know, just with watching the traffic on my website, we have a huge spike, of course. More people are checking it out.
Oh, sure.
But in November, it plateaus a little higher than it did before, meaning some people stick around. Some people, yeah. You know, stay there, and that's interesting to me. So
there's that residual effect, Jeff. You know,
that's right, of course. And so those of us that are out there talking about this, especially in October when we get really, really busy, you know, we have to keep that in mind, that some people are learning that there are places where you can discuss this. There are places that explore the topic. There are great radio programs like Coast to Coast, and they can tune in all 12 months, not just in October.
Well, it's a great period. We're in it right now, so it's going to be fun for you. When was the last time you were in costume?
October 31st, 2006.
So you do it, huh? You do it every year.
Oh, you're darn right. You know what? I do. I clear my schedule come Halloween night. I always do and always will. You know, when you come to my house, we've got no less than 6 strobe lights, 2 fog machines, tiki torches, music. It's going full board. And when you go that all out in your decorations, you know, don't scrimp. We get the full size candy bars. It's absolutely legendary in this neighborhood. The kids come for I'm not sure if they come for the spectacle or the full size candy bars. I'd like to think it was the spectacle, but I'm just not sure.
What monster are you?
You know, it changes every year. You got to keep things fresh, George, or you get stale. Last year, I was a robed skeleton, and we made a couple of kids cry. And one parent just really cracked me up. I mean, this girl couldn't have been more than like 3 years old, and she just waddled up looking for her candy bar, and there I am in a robe and a skull face. And her dad yells, "It's okay to be scared. That's part of the point." You know, a little 3-year old, like, hold her hand for God's sakes.
Where do you get the book, The Ghost Files?
The book's pretty much available everywhere. You can get it at Amazon or Barnes & Noble, Borders, or your favorite local bookstore. Or you can get it through ghostvillage.com.
Well, very good. And, Jeff, when we come back, let's talk about animal spirits, possession. Let's talk about skeptics as well. I think skeptics are very refreshing to whatever endeavor we're talking about. Our special guest tonight, Jeff Belanger, next hour we'll open up the phone lines. But when I come right back, we'll talk with him more about ghostvillage.com and some of the other work that he was talking about. Jeff, your little girl now, is she going to grow up loving ghosts?
I sure hope so. I read to her from my books every night. No, I'm just kidding. That would be a little weird. But yeah, no, I want to talk to her from a young age, and I want to, more than talk to her, I want to listen to her as she's, you know, she's just getting to that stage where she's starting to try to form words, and I want to listen. I want to hear what she has to say about things she sees and believes before she's ruined, you know, from growing up. It's really going to be a wonderful experience for both of us.
I ran into you at the Haunted Queen Mary. Right?
That's right.
What a great experience. No, but let me tell you, what a great experience that was. I had a great time doing that.
Yeah, that was. That was fun. You know, it's great getting to these conferences because you get to meet so many people that you've corresponded with over the years and read their work, and you finally get to meet in person, and that's the beauty of these great conferences. And that's such a great venue. You know, the Queen Mary, so much history on that ship and so many legends Boy, I hardly slept. I was just drinking it all in and meeting with so many people. And, yeah, it was great to meet you and your producer there. And
how often do you go there?
You know, I go there when they invite me. Typically, there's an event going on. The first time I went, I was probably about 12 years old. My family did the old West Coast vacation, and that was one of our stops. And I've been back twice since. So who knows when I'll be back again, but I know that they keep threatening to do another conference, so you never know.
Well, that's another thing I'd like to talk with you about when we come back, Jeff, and that's haunted places, because there've got to be thousands of them all around this country, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's and not only that, I mean, it's giving rise to a whole new, you know, cottage industry of supernatural tourism.
People like to be scared. Why?
Yeah, well, do they like to be scared, or is it, I'm sure that's part of it. I'm sure the titillating aspect is part of it, but I think also that people are trying to wrap their hands around this very big subject, and in the guise of doing it as a ghost investigation, I think it's an easy baby step to start with.
Well, you may be right. Stay with us, Jeff. We'll be back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to talk with Jeff Belanger. Maybe you want to share your ghost story with us. We'll be back in a moment. We'll talk about animal spirits, those who are skeptics, and also more on spirit communication and possession. All that on Coast to Coast AM. Take a few moments, Jeff. Animal spirits, what's your take on that entire phenomenon?
Yeah, it's interesting that some people, you know, certainly seem to encounter something that's more than just, you know, a human spirit. You know, I remember early on someone telling me about their own experience where they're sitting on a bed and they had a beloved cat that had passed on, and they felt something pounce on the bed, and they saw little footfalls, right, pushing into the comforter, just step, and then it disappeared. And you sit there and you say, well, you know, I was raised Roman Catholic, and so the whole notion of the soul is strictly a human trait, is what that belief system teaches. I don't know how much I agree with that anymore. I know this gets into a bit of a religious discussion, but all living things seem to have some sort of spirit to them. And if you think about our pets, they've got, you know, personality, they've got their own little quirks, the things we love about them, and they show us affection, we show them affection. Certainly there's a strong bond there, and I could see why we would want them to hang around even after they pass on, and I could see why they may want to hang around even after they pass on. The evidence is there to suggest that some of these ghost encounters aren't human. Another woman who wrote to me told me that around Christmas time, she always had to keep ornaments off of her Christmas tree near the bottom. Anyone who owns a cat would probably echo this same story, because the cat will bat at it and knock it to the ground and break these things. And so for years, they had no ornaments on the lower foot and a half of their Christmas tree. And then the year their cat died, they said it was kind of a sad moment because they could put the ornaments down there this year. And then they were noticing that they'd sit there and watch some of these ornaments just be batted by some invisible force knocking the thing around. And you know, you say, well, what would cause that? What's going on here? There's something to it. There's some life force that I think runs through all living things, and maybe it's something residual where it leaves an imprint on an area, not just a bad one, sometimes a positive one, like our little cat friends. Or maybe it's again that transition period where they're still half in our plane and half in another, and moving, you know, on the way to moving out. I'm not completely sure, but there's definitely something to it, because we hear these reports again and again. I know there was a cemetery in Connecticut, in Naugatuck, Connecticut, that I once looked into, that many reported a ghost of a horse that would be seen in the area. Specifically, you'd hear the clip-clop of the hoofs, but sometimes people would also see what looked like a stallion just kind of run through the cemetery and then vanish. And so there's, you know, the same evidence is there to suggest animal spirits as there are to suggest human spirits.
Do you think that the closer the animal might be to a human being, like your dog, like your cat, very close family pets, most of them live in the house, the more apt that spirit connection is supposed to be?
Well, I do believe that, you know, anything that we're connected to, you know, especially our loved ones, people, our pets, things like that, when you have that bond, it's just a reason for people to stay close. You know, God, I think about the pets I've had, and you're happiest, and they seem happiest when you're close. I mean, think about it. You know, if you've been gone all day, anyone who's ever had a dog knows, you know, you're gone all day, you come home. What a sight to come home to. This creature is just overjoyed that you're simply there, you know, that you just, you're in their world again. And I think that those bonds don't go away just because one of you dies. You know, and it works the other way as well, not just if the pet dies, but in some cases we hear about the human dies and the pet insists on hanging around, you know, his master's favorite chair or the bed, or seems to be following something invisible, you know, throughout the house. It's definitely a two-way street. That bond just doesn't seem to be broken, even in death.
Let me ask you about these historic haunts now, these spots all around the country. What are some of your favorite places?
Well, I do love the Queen Mary, definitely. That's just such a great story, you know, because this was a transatlantic ocean liner. It saw military service in World War II. It's, you know, the old golden age of transatlantic crossing before the airplane kind of, you know, trumped that. But that's certainly a favorite one, and so many legends all over that ship. On the East Coast, one place I come back to again and again is the White House, and I have a children's book coming out next year on the ghosts of the White House, a nonfiction children's book, which I'm
really
excited about. Yeah, it's in fact, we were just going through the copy edits this week, and it's a look at history through the eyes of the ghosts. And I called the White House. This was a few years ago that I started working on this, and I spoke to the boss at the time, who was a man named Gary Walters. He was the chief usher for every president since Nixon. He just retired this year. And I said, hey, you know, I'm interested in some of the ghostly legends, I wasn't surprised. He said, you know, we really don't talk about that too much, and we know they're here. And I said, yeah, but you know what we're doing? I'm working on a children's book, and we're going to use ghosts as an innovative way to teach history. And he said, you know what? Okay, come on down. And I got to go interview Gary Walters inside the White House, get the tour of the building, talk with some of the Secret Service and some of the staff. And it was an incredible, incredible experience just to be there. And what blew me away even more than, you know, being a history buff and being in that building was how forthcoming everybody was in discussing the ghost there. A Secret Service agent I talked to who knew everything, every detail of the room, could tell you how old that carpet was, who painted that painting, what the bust, you know, the Clintons brought in this carpet in 1996 just to replace the old one. This chair was made in Connecticut. This, you know, that old stuffed cushion came from Europe, whatever. They knew everything. And so I'd ask, well, you know, what about the ghosts here? And without missing a beat, he said, yes, sir, we understand. Abraham Lincoln's up on the second floor near the Lincoln bedroom, and a British redcoat's been seen out near the North Portico. And I said, wow. You know, the same tone of voice that he described the chair, the cushion, the table, and the rug, he talked about the ghosts. And then the chief usher. Now, these are people, you have to understand, there's about 100 employees of the White House that work for that building, regardless of which political party is in power. It doesn't matter. These are the ushers, the butlers, the cleaning crew, the foremen, the electricians, the groundskeepers. These folks work for the building, and some of them have worked there for many years. Some of them, their fathers work there and their grandfathers work there. They have spent more time in that building than any president, because at most, any president can only live there for 8 years. You know, and they're not there all the time even during that. But these folks have been there for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, been there at all hours of the day and night, working functions. And they've got ghost stories. They've got ghost stories to share about that building. And I think what I'm excited about is that it is a different way to teach history, because you can't understand the ghosts unless you put them in the context of who they were in history and what impact they had on the country. So that's certainly a place I come back to, you know, time and again.
What about some of the spots that people can freely get into without much hassle?
Yeah, that one's a little tricky to get into.
Oh, yeah.
Gettysburg, of course, I come back to again and again. And what's wonderful about that is, if you like crowds, you can stay downtown and you can learn about some of the, you know, wonderful historic buildings that also have their ghosts attached. If you want to get away from the crowd, you've got many hundreds of acres of haunted land. You've got a battlefield that just sprawls out in all directions, and you can have your alone time if you want quiet and just to kind of soak all that in. And you can go to some places where really history left quite a mark. And when you consider 51,000 dead or wounded in just 3 days back in 1863, my goodness, it's just a powerful, powerful place. And, you know, you don't have to be psychic to sense that when you're in a place like Gettysburg. Also, a place like New Orleans, a city like New Orleans with so many cultures that come together there. The Caribbean voodoo culture, the Catholic culture, the Great Americana, the Mississippi Delta, all of that coming together, and their ghostly legends are as good as their food and their music. Really, a part of it. You know, that's certainly one city where ghosts are absolutely embraced. It's as much a part of the city and the history as are the buildings, and really a great place to check out if you're interested in this stuff.
Jeff, would you like to stay in a room where you know has been haunted, where other people have said, you know what, at 3 o'clock in the morning, this thing just pops up and it's the eeriest thing? Would you stay in that room overnight?
I do. I have. I would.
Still.
Absolutely.
How about your wife? Would she do it?
You know, she's the yin to my yang. She'll play along up to a certain point, you know. Okay. If the room was free, she'd probably say, all right, well, let's see what happens. You know, but otherwise, you know, I should probably shy away a little bit. But yeah, I think that's always an opportunity. One of the things that interests me is why do some places get these these haunted reputations. Why are people drawn to certain, you know, locations? And not just locations, like you said, in some buildings, like a hotel room, one room in particular has its legends, others do not. And why is that? I mean, certainly maybe there was a tragedy that took place in that room, a suicide, a murder, who knows? But you know, are there places on Earth that are simply more prone to this than others? Is that part of this phenomenon? Some evidence points to it. I mean, a place like Gettysburg, you don't have to, you just understand how many people died there in such a short period of time. That simply must leave a mark that really can never be washed away. But in other cases, you know, there are people who die in other hotel rooms of heart attacks or whatever, and those rooms are not necessarily haunted. Why this one?
See, but I wouldn't want to stay in that room. I mean, I would really be ticked off at a hotel if I checked in and they put me in the room where some guy died. I don't know why, but I don't want it. I just feel eerie about that, Jeff.
I'm sure they wouldn't tell you, so that's the good news.
No. Are they obligated to tell me, even in a hotel, that some guy died of a heart attack 5 months ago or something like that?
I'm not aware of them being obligated. And how would they know? I mean, the person at the front desk may not even be aware of which room it was if they even heard about it.
You know, well, they can flag the room, though, on the computer, you know?
Yeah. No, that's a good question, because I know there are many real estate laws that when you buy a house, you can ask if anyone ever died in the house. And that's something that has to be disclosed if the potential buyer asks. So I guess why not in a hotel? But that's one of the interesting things. I was up in Juneau, Alaska, and I was at the Alaskan Hotel, which is it was actually the first hotel in Juneau when the city was just, you know, being born out of a gold mining town. And I was talking to the guy at the front desk who said, yeah, this room on the third floor near the front of the building, I'll put people in there, and constantly they'll come down and they'll ask to be moved. It happens again and again in that room and not in others. And some people are you know, just come out and say, that room is haunted. There's a woman that I see in there, and it's freaking me out. Move me. Others don't say so much, but they just ask to be moved. And he's like, if I have an open room, I just move them. It's pretty much that simple. So again, these places that are the magnets for the phenomenon interest me to no end. And if given the choice, I'd rather stay in that room than any other.
We've talked about skeptics. I think they're refreshing. What about you?
Yeah, absolutely. True skeptics bring so much to the discussion, because if you're researching a place, if you're doing an investigation, you know, sometimes there is a logical explanation, and if you bring someone in who's looking for the simple answer before the supernatural, it can help quite a bit. It really, truly can. Like I said before, the problem is when it gets to be someone operating under a belief system called atheism, which means they refuse any evidence that's contrary to what they already believe. And belief is not science. It's just belief. It's your notion. It's your gut, which is okay. And it's okay not to believe, but at the same time, I don't know, don't call yourself a scientific skeptic when in fact you're just, you have an agenda. But no, it absolutely is refreshing. There's so much good work that they offer to this. And I wish that more people could work together, because I think it tends to be an us versus them scenario in too many cases when it shouldn't be. I think they're actually on the same quest we are. I think they want to know themselves, but they want to see, you know, they want to see it presented properly. And that's certainly a very reasonable request.
Well, I love it when I get phone calls, Jeff, and we may get some next hour when somebody calls and says, I was a skeptic, I didn't believe any of this stuff, mumbo jumbo, and all of a sudden I saw my mother who died last year, you know, at the foot of my bed or calling me on the phone. And then they're staunch believers. They're believers in this.
Yeah, that, of course. And you know what? How many people have said, well, I wouldn't believe it unless I see it. And that's a very reasonable position to take. But at the same time, I think one of the frustrating things for people that do end up sharing their ghost experience is when someone looks at them and says, you know, well, that didn't happen. That couldn't have happened. You're lying. That is so frustrating for people. It's like me asking you what you had for breakfast and saying, no, there's no way you had eggs and toast for breakfast today.
Well, there isn't in my case.
Right. You know, you had a piece of fruit. I know you did. And I mean, well, wait a minute. I wasn't there when you had breakfast today. How would I know? And who am I to judge your human experience when I wasn't even there to begin with? And I think that's one of the frustrating parts. And that's one of the things where, you know, some skeptics, not all, can actually be a detriment to getting anywhere. Because when you're just going to create an argument as opposed to a dialogue, that's just going to get you nowhere quick. But you're right, seeing is believing, and that's the thing to me. When you meet someone who was an atheist, who was a skeptic, who said, you know, I didn't really buy into any of this, and there it was, you know, that's a whole new person now.
And people are apt to ridicule those who see everything that's unusual, UFOs,
of course,
Bigfoot sightings. People who don't see this will not believe it, and they'll ridicule, won't they?
Of course. And you know what it is? It's because some of these experiences are an affront to their belief system. It's the same thing if you talk to someone who's very zealous about their religion, whatever it is. I don't care which team they're rooting for. Someone who really believes in a big way, they don't want to hear about anything that might be counter to what they already believe. It makes them angry. It makes them uncomfortable. It makes them feel like they're in danger, because you're threatening their world. I mean, gosh, look at the turmoil in the Mideast. You know, millions of Muslims have been convinced that it's a war against their religion, and not necessarily the regimes or the governments that run some of these countries. And that is more threatening than, you know, well, overthrow my government, yeah, that's fine, but try to wipe out my religion. Now we have a problem, you know, and they've been convinced that it's kind of one and the same, which is makes this matter so much more delicate than just a simple war of yesteryear, you know, where it was just simply over territory or whatever. Belief is so powerful. It's the reason those pieces of paper in your wallet are worth something. Why is the 20 worth more than the one? You know, they're made from the same paper, they're the same size, roughly the same color, similar designs. But we collectively believe, we collectively agree that banknote that is the 20 is worth more than the one. And that belief makes things very real for a lot of people.
Speaking of belief systems, do you believe in psychics?
Yeah, I think there's something to it. I think we all have intuition. I don't consider myself a seer of any kind. You know, a psychic is a doorknob. But at the same time, I get gut instincts. I get impressions on anything from, I mean, think about, you know, the people you meet. Some folks you meet and you say, wow, this is a great person. This is someone I'd like to know better. Or you know, the opposite. You meet someone and all they say to you is, hello, how do you do? And you just bristle. You say, my goodness, there's something about this person I just don't like. That's kind of a psychic sense. It's kind of a gut instinct. And we act on that. We act on that on business ideas. We act on that on creative ideas and in personal relationships and romantic relationships. I think you could label all that psychic to some degree. Now, whether some people have a true gift of prophecy where they can actually, you know, see into the future, that has yet to be proved to me. But I do believe there are people that are certainly more sensitive than others to, you know, these things that are in our environment anyway. And you know, some of us are just better at picking it up than others.
Well, there's no doubt that there are people who are truly tuned in.
Sure. Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting to me is that the whole notion of a sixth sense, I'm not sure it's a sixth sense, or is it just an extension of the existing five? Are there people that can just, you know, think about when people lose their eyesight, often their hearing becomes much better because they tune into that sense more. Is the psychic ability simply an extension of the senses, the extension of touch, the extension of hearing, of sight? Maybe. That's kind of where I'm leaning.
Okay, well, stay with us. We're going to lean right your way when we come back with phone calls now with Jeff Belanger. You want to share ghost stories or you have a question for him? You're next on Coast to Coast AM.